seems okay with everybody. Let me ramp up microphone, speakers. Okay. All right. Everything seems to be fairly straightforward. Okay. Excellent. Okay. Good. Everyone can hear. Because like I said, I'm very excited about what we're talking about this evening. If you've watched the video lecture of my Common Objections to Capitalism talk, or if you've listened to it online, this is going to be kind of a version of that, perhaps in slightly greater detail. But we're going to borrow from a couple of really neat things I think that happened today. You should have seen, as Danny and I were fussing with technology, you probably saw a link to, or maybe you watched the entirety of the new Hayek Haynes rap video that's been put together by econstories.tv. John Popola, who just recently left Spike TV to start his own company called Emergent Orders to do things like this. And actually my former boss at Washington University in St. Louis, Russ Roberts, these guys are the brains behind this whole operation. And the new Keynes Hayek video is really spectacular. The production quality is excellent. The lyrics are great. I'm not going to comment on the quality of the music because I'm not an expert on hip hop or rap or anything like that. But they do an absolutely fantastic job with it. And I knew when I was watching it that there were probably going to be a couple of people with names that you might find familiar as you're watching the video. The first at the beginning, the security guard is Mike Munger, who is a regular guest on Econ Talk, actually a fellow WashU Econ PhD, and former chair of the political science department at Duke. So he's the security guard. If you know Ed Stringham, who is a name that should be very familiar in Austrian circles, he's actually one of the reporters. He's the one who tramples Hayek to get to Keynes. He currently teaches at Fayetteville State University in North Carolina. Actually, I think he lives in New York, but he's the editor of the Journal of Private Enterprise, former president of the Association of Private Enterprise Education. But the cameo appearance that really kind of geeked me out about this was when someone pointed out that the person playing Mises in Friedrich Hayek's corner, that's Joe Salerno. So those of you who are interested in this course, you probably read the postscript that he wrote to Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth. I honestly didn't recognize him without his beard, honestly, but I can't think of anybody who would have been a better person to play Mises and be Hayek's corner man than Salerno. So it was really that was the touch I think that made it truly beautiful and truly brilliant. So if I were you, I would watch the video and share it with kind of everybody that you know. Second, we finished the semester today at Rhodes. We finished our classes. We have exams and things next week, and I've got students turning in research papers, and I have a stack of Econ 323, which is Classical and Marxian Political Economy. Papers to grade on capitalism, socialism, and the mixed economy. We spent a good amount of time today in class wrapping up and talking about theories for why some places are very rich and other places are very poor, and also thinking about the possibility of capitalism, the impossibility of socialism, and kind of exactly what we're doing. So if I have it handy, I don't know that I do. I read students. Okay, yeah, it's not here, but. Anyway, I read students a handful of quotes, from a couple of them from Mises and one from John Maynard Keynes. Keynes, while I disagree with him a lot about business cycle theory and things like that, the man could turn a phrase. And he once gave a toast to the economists who, in his words, are the trustees not merely of civilization but of the possibility of civilization. And I charged my students with that thought and with a couple of ideas from the last couple of paragraphs of chapter 38 of Human Action, The Place of Economics in Learning, where Mises talks about all of these different interventions and these various policies that were made on the basis of pure economic ignorance. And he pointed out that the only way to fight that is to never relax in the pursuit of truth. So that's my goal. My goal as an educator, my goal as a faculty member is not necessarily to show students what all of the answers are, because I don't know what all the answers are, but rather to be unyielding and unrelaxing in my pursuit of truth and to I hope, inspire people with whom I come in contact to do the same. So with that, let's talk about the cultural and environmental critique of capitalism, and let's pursue a little bit of truth with respect to the market economy. So as we have discussed, when you take Mises seriously, when you take Hayek seriously, you realize that economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth is literally impossible. Okay, so you cannot have rational economy. You can't have rational economic calculation. Indeed, as Salerno argues in his postscript, it's not entirely clear that you can have rational thought in the absence of private ownership of the means of production. That was demonstrated in spades over the course of the 20th century. And then finally, with the collapse of communism in Europe and the former Soviet Union, Hayek and Mises were ultimately and finally vindicated in terms of what they had to say about the development, or lack thereof, of the communist economy. To digress just a little bit, at the Association of Private Enterprise Education meetings a few weeks ago, Pete Vetke made what I thought was a very, very important point. And this gets back a little bit to what I was saying earlier about Mises on being unyielding in the pursuit of truth. He said the Austrians predicted the three major events of the 20th century, the three most important events of the 20th century, the Great Depression, the fall of communism, and the stagflation of the 1970s. He asked, and indeed I would ask too, why are Austrian economists not the mainstream? I would like to, someday I would like for that to be the case. The emergence of the Keynes-Hayek rap video suggests at least that we're making a little bit of progress. And what the Austrians have to say about capitalism as not merely an economic system, but also as a cultural system, is, I think, of fundamental and first order importance. So people will claim, okay, yeah, it may very well be that capitalism delivers the goods. And most socialists, most people with socialist or interventionist leanings are willing to admit that much, that capitalism does in fact deliver the goods. But to say, well, at what price? What do we give up in order to have a capitalist economy? Do we not lose something important by having a capitalist economy? So my reaction to this is twofold. First, I congratulate the socialist or the interventionist on what appears to be their first use of marginal reasoning to say, okay, well, at what price? At the margin, we're getting one thing, we're giving up something else. What are we giving up in order to get this thing that you call capitalism? Okay, so that's a step in the right direction, you know, to know that value is determined at the margin, that decisions are made at the margin, and to know that there's no free lunch. Okay, so these are good things. These are steps in the right direction. The second part of my response to the socialist or the interventionist is, well, no, it's obvious that we're not losing our souls by getting and spending, or we're not laying waste our powers by getting and spending. We're getting the world, we're gaining the world, and we're gaining fuller, richer, more human souls in a very true and very serious way. I have probably more to say about that in just a minute, but I think what is emerging in the research program on political economy is an idea of a robust political economy and a robust classical liberalism. I think a robust libertarianism and ultimately a robust free market anarchism, basically showing that these institutions and these ideas persist even when we make, even when we relax the assumptions, even when we change assumptions in favor, allegedly in favor, of the socialists, the case for capitalism gets that much stronger. So let's consider some of the claims that people make about capitalism. Very quick outline, we're going to talk about exploitation, we're going to talk about environmental degradation, and we're going to talk about the spiritual, emotional, and cultural consequences of the capitalist order. So let's talk about exploitation. Big one, capitalism exploits the poor. So in a capitalist economy, maybe we get rich, we get very, very rich. Those riches are distributed unequally. One of two things happens. Either first, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. So the poor actually get materially worse off in a capitalist economy, while the rich are getting materially better off as a result of their participation in a capitalist economy. That's in an absolute sense, we're increasing the poverty and the immiseration of the poor by having capitalism. Maybe we have a bigger pile of stuff as a result, and maybe we have a bigger array of services, but those are all being enjoyed by capitalists, or those are all being enjoyed by the rich. A second possibility is that capitalism might create economic growth for everybody. The rich get richer and the poor get richer. However, the rich get richer much more rapidly than the poor. You might have seen an organization I at first learned about in the months leading up to the 2000 election, called Billionaires for Bush or Gore, which I thought was kind of clever. It pointed out that members of the political class are kind of beholden to special interests, no matter whether those members of the political class are Republicans or Democrats. I thought it was kind of cute. But the phrases that they used in their propaganda or in their outreach was inequality isn't growing fast enough. So the idea is, you know, we want to have a president, whether it's Bush or Gore, who will make inequality grow more rapidly. The idea there is that, okay, yeah, sure, maybe the poor, the people at the bottom of the pyramid of the capitalist system that you might see in front of you, are maybe a little bit better off, but they're getting a pittance relative to what the capitalists are earning and relative to what the economic system is producing for the very, very wealthy. How does this square with the facts? In 2007, an economist named Gregory Clark published a very interesting and very important book called A Farewell to Alms, A Brief Economic History of the World. And there are parts of Clark's argument that a lot of scholars take issue with. You know, he makes, I'm not entirely sold on his argument for why Britain grew rather than everybody else. He argues that there was downward pressure in a Malthusian economy, the elites bred more rapidly, and since there was downward pressure as a result of Malthusian constraints, eventually the virtues of the elites, things like honesty and integrity and whatnot, things that make for good capitalism, filtered down through to the British lower classes, and boom, we got economic growth. Plausible, possible. It's an interesting story. I'm not entirely sure I buy it. But I think one of the most important things that Clark contributes is in chapter 14 of his book, he evaluates very specifically some of the claims that are made first by classical economists and second by the critics of classical economics like Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. So if you think about how income can be divided up in a private economy, so income can flow to three different potential income earners. Income can flow as rent to land. So income can flow as rent to land and natural resources. The owners of land and natural resources will absorb some of the income. Rent can flow as profits to the owners of capital. Or income can flow as wages to the owners of labor. There are a couple of different predictions of classical and Marxian political economy. One of the predictions of the classical school that we associate with David Ricardo is that since land is a fixed factor, all of the income that the economy produces is going to accrue to the owners of land and of natural resources. So the land owners are the ones who are going to get rich. Wages are going to tend toward subsistence. A second prediction of classical and Marxian political economy is the Marxian prediction that income is going to flow primarily and indeed exclusively, well, not exclusively, but almost exclusively, to the owners of capital. The owners of capital are going to appropriate surplus value from the production process strictly as a result of the capitalist mode of production itself. It's inherent in the nature of the system. It's not necessarily because of evil intentions on the part of the capitalist. It's just that the laborer owns only his labor. The laborer converts natural resources into finished goods and services using the capital that is forwarded to him or her by the capitalist. And thus, the product of the worker's labor confronts him as something alien, as something outside himself. Here I'm paraphrasing Marx. Marx says that this is the essence of alienation in the capitalist mode of production, is that the product of labor, the labor itself, confronts the worker as something alien. The worker earns subsistence wages. So Marx is very much a Ricardian in this sense. And all of the income flows to the owners of capital. There's another prediction, and this is one that's sort of broadly consistent with neoclassical economics in its Austrian and other varieties, and that is that income might in fact flow to labor. So the beneficiaries of industrialization might not be the capitalists or the landowners, but rather the unskilled workers themselves. And indeed, that's exactly what we observe. That's exactly what we observe. We get an explosion in real wages, starting roughly around the end of this, end of the 17th, middle of the 18th century. We get this explosion in real wages, not necessarily for unskilled labor, not necessarily for skilled labor, but for unskilled labor. So the benefits of industrialization accrued not to the owners of land, not to the owners of capital, and indeed not even necessarily to skilled workers, but to unskilled laborers. They were the big winners. The rental rate of capital, the interest rate, stayed roughly the same over the course of, say, the last 1,000 years. The rental rate on an acre of land in England stayed roughly the same, again, over the course of 1,000 years or so, with massive fluctuations, but nonetheless, no general upward trend. What really exploded was unskilled wages. So this idea that capitalism exploits the poor is unfounded in fact. If anything, capitalism is a process by which the previously poor exploit the rich and then become rich themselves. And I think that's really, as someone who cares about the poor, who wants to see, someone who doesn't like death and starvation and all of the horrible things that we associate with poverty, I think that's something that is an absolutely fantastic feature of the capitalist system, that it in fact alleviates all of the problems for which most of its critics blame it. So capitalism exploits the poor. Maybe capitalism ignores the poor. We talk about all the wonderful things that capitalism brings, but maybe capitalism just it leaves the poor behind. Some people are left behind as a result. Those who are living on less than a dollar a day in the world, living in extreme poverty, are perhaps left behind as a result of the capitalist system. But what we just saw, or what we just said, is that capitalism actually redounds primarily to the benefit of the very, very poor. Capitalism creates most, the fruits of the capitalist system accrue not, again, to the owners of land, not to the owners of capital, and not even to skilled laborers, but to unskilled workers. We have a lot, we have abundant evidence of this in studies of the effects of migration on wages. For example, for a very, very, very poor person who moved to the United States from Mexico, simply crossing the border might increase their wages by a factor of 5. The economist Lant Pritchett, who wrote a fantastic book called Let Their People Come, it's about the economics and ethics, indeed, of immigration, says that if you take a Bangladeshi worker, the increase in their income from a lifetime of access to microcredit, things like the Grameen Bank, or things like Kiva.org, or any of these organizations that are out there to provide small loans to entrepreneurs in very poor countries, the increase in their income from a lifetime of that is roughly equal to the increase in their income that they would get from working in the United States for 8 weeks. So this suggests capitalism doesn't ignore the poor. If anything, capitalism makes the poor much better off. And the problem of poverty is not that capitalism is exploiting poor people or that capitalism is ignoring poor people, but that poor people don't have access to capitalism. In one sense, and I know this is a hot button issue for a lot of people, rich capitalist countries like the United States and many European countries, we have our guns turned outward. We don't want to let people move here, in spite of the fact that the evidence suggests that the impact on natives' wages, if anything, is positive. And the people who might lose in the short run from increased immigration, say high school dropouts primarily, the signal that I would get from that is not shut out the immigrants, but stay in school and don't drop out of high school. That's one reason why they don't have access to capitalist institutions. Another is that they live in countries that are run by, in many cases, thugs, thieves, and madmen, who are, if anything, actively thwarting the capitalist process. So what the world's poor need in a nutshell, what the world's poor need in a nutshell is not foreign aid, but access to the capitalist system. I would look up Steve Horowitz writes a great weekly column for the Foundation for Economic Education. This week he wrote on how the free market has room for everybody. And I think that's great and it's wonderful. It's fantastic. And a few years ago, Michael Strong wrote a really neat column for TCS Daily. You can tell because it made an impression on me. I read it, I think, in 2006, in which he said, if anything, the world's poor need access to the Walmart supply chain. Microcredit is great and all, but poor people are not going to get rich by selling eggs to other poor people. They're going to get rich by producing consumers' goods for the world, for the richest people in the world. Unfortunately, there's a gigantic movement of people on the left who are trying as hard as they can to prevent the flow of capital from rich countries to poor countries, and the human tragedy of this is enormous. Lots and lots and lots of people who are far worse off than they otherwise would be and should be. I'm going to end our discussion of that and direct you to the work of Benjamin Powell, who has online a couple of great talks and a few interesting articles on the economics of sweatshops. It turns out that, lo and behold, sweatshops are in fact good for the people who get to work there. Why? Because they're better than the alternative. Okay, so maybe capitalism delivers the goods, and maybe capitalism doesn't ignore the poor. Maybe capitalism doesn't exploit the poor, but capitalism is structurally racist and structurally sexist. Capitalism allows us and indeed perhaps encourages us to discriminate against people who are not like us, to discriminate on the basis of wholly arbitrary characteristics like race and gender rather than productivity. I'll be honest, there's an extent to which I have no idea where this argument comes from, because first of all, it doesn't square at all with the facts, and second of all, it doesn't square with the theory. It may very well be the case that some people have a taste for discrimination. So for example, maybe let's just suppose for sake of argument that I'm a racist and I don't want to buy food from blue people. I don't like blue people. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe for whatever reason they just rub me the wrong way. I don't like blue people, and I decide that I don't want to do business with blue people. That's what Gary Becker will call a taste for discrimination. Maybe I'm willing to forego some material satisfaction in order to indulge my taste for discrimination, but the capitalist process is such that if I decide that I want to discriminate against people who are blue, I'm going to have to pay a price for it in the form of lower profits. And indeed, all of my competitors out there who don't have a taste for discriminating against blue people, they're going to scoop up all of the potential blue labor that I'm leaving on the table. They're going to hire that blue labor. They're going to increase their profits and indeed perhaps drive me out of business. So if I want to stay out of, if I want to stay in business, I can be as racist as I want, but I'm going to have to pretend, I'm going to have to do my business as if I were not. So the outcome should be a minimization of discrimination, if anything else. Now, this is not to say that discrimination won't happen, that people won't do horribly unethical things, but the fact of the matter is, in a capitalist free market competitive economy, they're going to pay a price for it. The problem with socialism and the problem with any type of interventionism is that often those interventions shield the people with racist preferences from the capitalist comeuppance that they would get as a result of the competitive market process. I have Walmart on here because I do a lot of research on Walmart. I've published a number of papers in refereed journals on Walmart, and have an article that was in the Freeman, about 2 years ago now, or a year and a half, something like that, on Walmart. Walmart is they're the defendants in the largest class action lawsuit that has ever been certified. Something like 1.6 million people, so 1.6 million women, claiming that Walmart is structurally sexist, that Walmart has discriminated against people. I'm a little bit skeptical of this for a couple of reasons. Again, you're going to have some serious, awful, terrible things that are going to go on in the world, and you're likely to see a lot of it happening at Walmart. Why? Because they employ something like 2 million people. If 1% of the people that worked at Walmart were absolute scoundrels, 1% of the people who work at Walmart are absolute scoundrels, that's 20,000 absolute scoundrels that work for Walmart. If 1/10 of 1% of the people who work for Walmart are absolute scoundrels, that's 2,000 people still who are absolute scoundrels who work for Walmart. So, but yeah, a lot of people are not going to find that necessarily satisfying. While I don't doubt that some awful things have gone on under the that have gone on at Walmart in the past, my guess is a lot of that's going to be rooted out. And indeed, what we should expect to see if Walmart is in fact being structurally racist and sexist is someone else, upstart Mart or something like that, coming in and hiring away all of Walmart's discriminated against employees, or hiring away all of Walmart's exploited employees and picking up the profits that Walmart is leaving on the table by trying to, by deciding to indulge their taste for discrimination. So I'm not really sure how the Dukes versus Walmart case is going to pan out, but I'm reasonably certain that Walmart is, that if Walmart were engaged in systematic patterns of discrimination, that it would be the market process itself that would reveal those rather than a legal decision. On Walmart specifically, the company's been criticized for a lot of different things, and they've been criticized first for being ruthlessly obsessed with profits. I'll stop at nothing to increase their profits. They've also been accused of discriminating against women, discriminating, I think, also against ethnic minorities. What's interesting is that those two things in a competitive marketplace probably can't be true at the same time. You're either ruthlessly and morbidly focused on profits, or you're willing to leave money on the table in order to indulge a taste for discrimination. It's either or. It's almost certainly not both and, unless under very, very, very specific circumstances. So, again, one of the interesting things about capitalism, one of the neat things about the market economy, is that it roots out and punishes racism and sexism rather than perpetuating them. So, if the things that you care, if the kinds of justice issues that you care about are eradicating racial discrimination, eradicating gender discrimination, you should be wanting more free markets and more capitalism rather than less. One of the big ones is this idea that capitalism despoils and destroys the environment. People say, okay, yeah, sure, capitalism gives us all sorts of neat stuff, but you know, we're ruining the environment, we're ruining the air, we're ruining the water as a result of having free markets, free trade, and free capitalism. What we need to do is rein in our capitalist impulses and rein in our greed and rein in giant corporations in order to prevent capitalism from further despoiling and destroying the environment. A couple of things here. First, I'm going to see if this link will work. The link will not work. Okay, so here's something I'm going to do. All right. I'm going to post the link in the chat window. Well, actually, no. You should have access to the PowerPoint slides via the website. So the link doesn't work. But let me describe for you what you would see if the link did in fact work. Actually, let's see here. So capitalism, socialism. This would not be the best use of her time for me to try to hunt this down. Craig J. Richardson, who is an economist at, I think it's Winston-Salem. It's either Winston-Salem State University or Salem College in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, has done a lot of really, really interesting work on Zimbabwe. And he has an aerial photograph, or actually it's a satellite photo of Zimbabwe that shows on one side of a very clearly demarcated line collective farms or commonly owned farms, and then on the other side, privately owned farms. The collectively owned farm side is brown and disgusting. So Danny's telling me I can use the share menu. Okay, but the we have the I'll tell you what, we'll worry about that later. The commonly owned farms are disgusting. And the privately owned farms are green and lush and there's lots of water. Then we get a socialization of or we get land reform of these farms, and the land is redistributed and socialized. And you see beautifully and brilliantly that the land on the privately owned farm side of the line, now when it's collectivized, turns brown and gross and disgusting. It's a beautiful, beautiful illustration of an important point, which is that private property and free market capitalism protect the environment because they give people incentives to conserve, because they give people incentives to take care of what belongs to them. Why? Because the people who own the stuff are bearing the full costs and enjoying the full benefits of whatever it is they're doing with that property. That's one way in which capitalism protects the environment. Another way that capitalism protects the environment. Okay, great, excellent. Thank you. Thanks, Danny. So let me again. Let me see if this works here. Okay. All right. I honestly don't remember where the share menu is, but. So what we'll do is we'll just move on. Okay, so another way in which capitalism protects the environment is by ensuring ensuring the survival of endangered species. Now, granted, it's not exactly clear that endangered species are all going to persist when and if they're privately owned. Some of them might go extinct. But my guess is that first, the rate of extinction is likely to be low. And second, the species that are most valuable are going to be the ones that are least likely to go extinct. Two conversations that I've had about this. One, after my wife and I took our honeymoon, we will have been married for 8 years on June 21st. We took a Caribbean cruise and we came back and there's an aquarium in Tampa where our ship docked and where we were flying into and out of. And so we decided to go to the aquarium, and we went and we walked around, and you know, it's kind of neat, all sorts of fish and marine life and stuff. And they have these gigantic shark tanks, and I've ever since I was a kid, I've been fascinated by spiders and sharks. And spiders and sharks are just cool. And so we're watching these sharks swim around, and one of the shark keepers is giving a presentation and talking about how the sharks are endangered, and we need to do what we can to protect the sharks. We have to save the sharks. We need this law and that law. The other law to protect the sharks. So my hand goes up, and my wife of, by this point, I think 7 days, is thinking, oh, goodness, so what have I gotten myself into? And I ask, are you allowed to own and farm the sharks? And the answer is no. You're not allowed to own and farm the sharks. Indeed, people have gotten in trouble for it. That, though, is precisely what needs to happen if we're going to make sure that the sharks survive. In Memphis, we have a very, very nice zoo in Memphis, and one of the exhibits at the zoo is a panda display. So we have a couple of pandas at the Memphis Zoo, and my son loves the pandas because they're just giant and they're fat, and they sit there and they eat bamboo, and they're really, really cute, and my son loves them. The first time that we went to see the pandas, I think it was actually before Jacob was born, but you know, my wife and I went to the zoo and we went to see the pandas. I remember having a very interesting discussion with one of the zookeepers about whether you should or should not be allowed to own these endangered pandas. Why? Well, I think the answer is obvious. When pandas are commonly owned, or when they're owned by the Chinese government, as pandas are, people are going to have reduced incentives to conserve and increased incentives to poach. So if we really care about pandas, then we should be allowed to do something I proposed on an exam question in the fall, which is McDonald's should be allowed to own pandas and serve them as panda deluxes. That would help to ensure the perpetual supply of and the a very low probability of extinction of the panda species. Another point that a lot of people make, or that you know, people claim that we're going to run out of resources. This is one of the sort of standard mantras of the environmentalist left, and it's one that frustrates me quite a bit, because it keeps coming back, even though it keeps getting refuted, and even though it has always been wrong. In the late 1960s, Paul Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb, and Ehrlich's argument was that we are all going to die. He wrote, and I quote, "The battle to feed humanity is over. Hundreds of millions of people are going to starve to death." He said, excuse me. he said, because we've literally outstripped or are outstripping our ability to feed ourselves. And he kept making this claim and making this claim and making this claim. And then Julian Simon, an economist, stepped up to the plate and said, okay, Ehrlich, if you are so sure of yourself, let's bet on this. One of the things that I admire about Simon as an economist is, first, he's a first-rate user of economic theory and of the predictions of basic price theory. Second, he was willing to put his money where his mouth was in terms of things about which he was confident, or he was at least willing to challenge other people to put their money where their mouths were on areas where they were most confident. So Simon said, the testable implication of your theory, Mr. Ehrlich, or Professor Ehrlich, is that if we're going to run out of resources because of population pressure, we should observe the prices of industrial commodities rising over any given period of time. So I'll bet anyone who wants it, he wrote this in the pages of a journal called Social Science Quarterly, anyone who's interested, I will bet $10,000, pick any bundle of commodities, the price will be lower in 10 years. Ehrlich and some of his friends jumped on it. They said, okay, we're going to take Julian Simon's money. And they agreed that what they would do is they would buy, quote unquote, a basket of industrial commodities consisting of $200 worth of chromium, $200 worth of nickel, $200 worth of tungsten, $200 worth of copper, and $200 worth of tin. I think I have those correct. And then what they would do, so they'd buy these in 1980, and on an appointed day in 1990, they would look at this, they would look at the prices of this basket of goods, they would adjust it for inflation, and then if the prices had gone down, they would interpret this as Simon winning the bet, and Ehrlich would pay the difference. If the price had gone up, they would interpret this as Ehrlich winning the bet, and Ehrlich would pocket the difference. When the appointed day came, the price of this bundle of commodities had fallen by about, what was it, 60%. On Sunday, I think it was like October 1st, 1990, Paul Ehrlich wrote Julian Simon a check for $576.07. Ehrlich did not just lose the bet. Ehrlich lost the bet in a convincing, compelling, and indeed, I would argue, humiliating fashion, but that nonetheless didn't shut him up. Later, Paul Ehrlich won a MacArthur Foundation Genius Award for raising awareness of environmental problems, and unfortunately, Julian Simon passed away. Actually, I don't know when Ehrlich won his MacArthur Foundation Award. I can't remember if it's before or after the bet. But nonetheless, he won the MacArthur Foundation Award. He lost the bet, and people who have studied this over the very, very long run have discovered that the evidence over even like a 100-year period is squarely in Julian Simon's favor. So capitalism does not despoil the environment. Capitalism cleanses the environment. Capitalism bends the environment to the satisfaction of human wants and human needs. Capitalism helps to ensure the safety and perpetuation of currently endangered species, and capitalism helps to ensure that we don't someday run out of real resources. Okay, so once again, I think the evidence is very, very clear, is very clearly on the side of free market capitalism. So one might again argue, well, this again may be true. You know, maybe capitalism delivers the goods. Maybe capitalism is good for the poor. Maybe capitalism protects the environment. But to quote Wordsworth, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. So instead of, so capitalism makes it so that instead of reflecting on the meaning of life and thinking contemplatively about great thoughts and great ideas and beauty and pretty things, we're instead going to the Android's dungeon and baseball card shop and buying comic books that mean nothing, or playing role-playing games, or sitting on our computer looking at Facebook and doing all sorts of stupid crap that, while materially we might be better off, we're spiritually impoverished by our material wealth. And this supposedly is one of the great cultural contradictions of capitalism. Again, in a word, no. One piece of evidence is exactly what we're doing now. Capitalism and free markets have made it so that thinking thoughts about really important ideas and thinking about the meaning of life and thinking about beautiful things is now far cheaper than it has ever been. If you have an eye product, you can probably carry around the 100 images of the 100 best paintings and recordings of the 100 best pieces of music and recordings of the 100 best lectures and copies of the 100 best books, and pick any aspect of human achievement, the 100 best, you can probably all fit it on a 32 gigabyte iPhone. I might not be right because I'm trying to actually record this using voice memos, but I fear that maybe my hard drive is full with videos of my kids or something like that. That might not be the case, but again, you know, pair the thought. Maybe you need 64 gigabytes, or maybe you need an external hard drive to fit all of this stuff. Still, the claim that we are spiritually impoverished by our material wealth is, at first glance, really kind of silly, but then second, not at all consistent with the evidence. Consider what we're doing right now, which is using technology, using wealth, and using our leisure, using the fact that we don't have to scratch the ground for 16 hours a day in order to get enough calories to avoid death. We're using what, you know, in my case is the evening hours between 6 and 7:30. For some of you, it's a little bit later. For others, it's a little bit earlier. We don't have to use this time scratching the ground trying to get calories. We can instead use it to talk about ideas and talk about the alleged spiritual impoverishment that we're experiencing, the alienation and demoralization that we're experiencing as a result of the capitalist mode of production. Deidre McCloskey, who is one of my intellectual heroes, argues primarily in the first 60 pages of her book Bourgeois Virtues, and then at greater length throughout her book Bourgeois Virtues, and also in her most recent book Bourgeois Dignity, that in fact we are spiritually ennobled by the fact that we have by the fact that we're so much richer, by the fact that we have access to free markets, and by the fact that free markets have made us wealthy. In one of the papers about Walmart that my co-author Charles Cordemanche and I have written, we looked at how Walmart diffusion affected people's participation in high culture activities. Excuse me for just a second. Goodness. How Walmart spread and diffusion affects the degree to which people participate in high culture activities, or how it affects our relationships with our friends and our families. And we find Walmart doesn't really matter that much for social capital. If anything, the effect is positive. But we do get some positive effects for high culture activities, things like going to the symphony and whatnot. We interpret this as indirect increases in real wealth we can attribute to Walmart. And more generally, in terms of the cultural critique of capitalism, this suggests that Walmart, and by proxy, capitalism, is in fact making us better off in terms of our cultural activities. So no, it's not at all clear that we're laying waste our powers in a capitalist society. Granted, we often make mistakes. I make mistakes all the time. I'm around college students who are from time to time. I almost want to weep because I see that they're not making the most of the opportunities that they have. We enjoy lowbrow things. A lot of us watch too much TV, but it's not at all clear that we're on net worse off as a result of the fact that we are part of a capitalist order. It has been claimed that capitalism is inherently unstable and prone to recessions. So we have to have some kind of intervention, at the very least, if not socialization of the means of production. Marx argued for socialization of the means of production based on the fact that free market capitalism was anarchic and chaotic. And this can't be tolerated. John Maynard Keynes, in the early 20th century, particularly in the 1920s and 1930s and through World War II, argued for direct stabilization policy because, in Keynes's words, it is only by accident or design that a wholly private economy could end up at full employment. There would always be some type of macroeconomic instability as a result of sticky wages, animal spirits, and this whole litany of things that Keynes claimed was wrong with capitalism. And as an aside, Keynes viewed himself in a sense as sort of like the savior of Western liberty, because he said if someone didn't fix capitalism, specifically him, then totalitarianism was right around the corner. And so he viewed himself in a sense as kind of the savior of the West from the encroachments of totalitarian communism. But as the Austrians have shown, and I'm thinking specifically of Hayek, in modern manifestations of Hayekian business cycle theory, primarily things promulgated by Robert Murphy or Roger Garrison's excellent book, Time and Money, we see that indeed it is the capital itself that is stable, that does not feature business cycles, and its attempts to manage that economy via monetary policy, the printing of money by a central bank, or via fiscal policy, stabilization policies like those that were advocated by Keynes, that in fact ultimately create the kinds of fluctuations that we're trying to deal with in the first place. So capitalism is not inherently unstable. It is not prone to recessions. If anything, it is interventionism that is inherently unstable and inherently prone to recession. Capitalism, it is argued, is prone to monopoly. Indeed, this is one of the ideas that emerged in the early 20th century and in the 1950s. Particularly, if you look at the research of John Kenneth Galbraith in the 1950s, part of his argument was that the capitalist system was inevitably going to tend toward absorption of entire industries by single firms. So this created a kind of an iron triangle of big government, big labor, and big business trying to manage the economic system. It was argued then that giant corporations would be the ones ultimately that sort of took over. Capitalism would be prone to monopoly, and that if something wasn't done, and if these monopolies weren't stopped, they would get all the money, and the welfare consequences would be profoundly negative, because if you've taken an introductory economics course, one of the standard arguments is that when you have a monopoly, when you have one firm in an industry, or a firm that faces a downward sloping demand curve for its own output, you're going to get less than the socially optimal amount of output, because firms will not produce units of output for which marginal value is greater than marginal cost. So that's part of the argument, that monopoly capitalists will absorb all of the income, and in addition to that, they will leave unproduced output that would otherwise be produced. So it will be inherently prone to monopoly, which is distributionally bad, and also on net inefficient. We've discovered in the late 20th century that and the early 21st that that's actually not true. If you look at the Fortune 500 in 1955, it is a very different composition from the Fortune 500 in 2010 and 2011. A lot of the firms today that we talk about as being potential monopolies, that we fear as being the firms that are going to take over the world, Walmart in retail, Google, Facebook, Apple, you know, people are making claims that these are potential monopolists. These are firms that did not exist when John Kenneth Galbraith was worrying about the problem of monopoly in the new industrial state. One thing, this is something that I find interesting, and I would encourage you, as you look through Mises resources, look up Peter Klein's lectures on topics related to industrial organization, like the economics of networks and things like that, because you get these ideas, or people will come up with these ideas that are plausible a little bit on the surface about how, say, Facebook is a natural monopoly, or Twitter is a natural monopoly, or Google is a natural monopoly, or this is a natural monopoly, that is a natural monopoly. And lo and behold, these almost all turn out to be unfounded in fact. I remember reading not terribly long ago, I think it was in 2009 when I was on the faculty at Mises University, reading an article claiming that MySpace was a natural monopoly. And this is after MySpace had their lunch eaten by Facebook already. So claims that Facebook and MySpace are going to tend toward monopoly, again, I don't think that any of that is founded. In fact, it's founded in plausible stories that might possibly be true, but again, that are inconsistent with our experience. One claim, for example, a lot of people claim that Apple is a natural monopoly because they have what's called first mover advantage in the production of smartphones. You know, Apple is the only, they were the first mover in the production of smartphones, therefore they're going to monopolize the whole market. That, again, is not true, because Apple was not the first mover in the smartphone market. I think it was RAM with the black market. Black market. Goodness, that would actually be a great name for a product. The black market. So someone out there is looking for a business idea. Come up with a black market. I'm not exactly sure what it's going to be, but I would probably buy it. So I think it was RIM with the BlackBerry. They had first mover advantage in smartphones, and now they're the ones, or they're part of the group that's talking about going after Apple because allegedly Apple has monopoly power. Another popular claim is that there's some things that are just too important to be left to the market, like healthcare or education, or fill in the blank here. Some things that are just too important to, So Danny points out the only way Apple will be able to charge monopoly prices via IP lawsuits, like how they're suing Samsung right now. Thank you for qualifying that. I would encourage you to take Stefan Kinsella's course on intellectual property. By way of very brief digression, I think a lot of the criticism that's being leveled at Google or Facebook or Apple is not necessarily because of their privileged position in terms of intellectual property. I don't think that people are criticizing them on that basis. I think they're criticizing them on the basis of a naive and flawed model of industrial organization, suggesting that since they can basically add users at zero marginal cost, they're necessarily going to control the entire market. But I think the IP discussion is something I'd be very interested in hearing Stefan Kinsella's thoughts on. So back to things that are just too important to be left to the market, like education and healthcare. Obviously, we don't want people to just die. So we need to socialize the means, not of production, but at least the means of medication or something like that. The means of curing people of diseases. We have something that is too important to be left to free market capitalism. This, I think, runs into the public choice critique that we associate with the movement for robust political economy. I would argue that no, there are not some things that are just too important to be left to the market. There are some things that are too important not to be left to the market. And I think healthcare and education are among those. Why is that? When firms or organizations or people are not responsive to profit and loss incentives, they have no incentive to use resources wisely, they have no incentive to use resources sustainably, and they have no incentive to deliver the product that people think that they're ultimately getting. So when we look at what socialized medicine has done, people can talk about its successes in terms of higher life expectancy or lower infant mortality and lower costs. But I think, first of all, those are systems that are not sustainable. And second of all, one of the ways that countries with socialized medicine compare favorably to the United States on things like life expectancy and infant mortality is that the infant mortality statistics are not compiled the same way. I don't know exactly how it's done in a lot of European countries, but in the United States, for example, if a child is born and the child is breathing, that's counted as a live birth. A child that is born and that is breathing and that dies outside the womb, I think they have to be outside for a certain period of time before it will be counted as a live birth. So a child that dies immediately after birth in the United States is counted in the infant mortality statistics. A child that dies immediately after birth elsewhere might not be counted in those infant mortality statistics. And I would encourage all of you to really look into this. This, I think, would be a great kind of like a Mises Daily article for someone if you want to write it, or a great blog post. Parenthetically, what I would like to see people doing, and I need to look over the essays people wrote as a comment on a post that I sent everyone not terribly long ago, is turn what you're learning here, if anything, into things that you can write about. Walter Block once said, I think very appropriately, we become immortal through our writing. And James Buchanan has said that writing is research. So one way that I learn is by writing a lot. And I realize that something that sounds, or that I think is very, very clear in my head, is something that is not quite as clear or not quite as well formed once I try to put it on paper or once I try to put it on a computer screen. So there are a lot of ways in which some things that might be too important to be left to the market are in fact too important not to be left to the market. Humberto Fontova, who some of you might know, he's written for LouRockwell.com in the past, pointed out one time when people were championing Cuban health statistics, Cuban infant mortality data, he pointed out that the abortion rate in Cuba is 3 times that in the United States. So children who might have a rough go of it in early childhood or who might not make it out of infancy, they're probably far more likely to be aborted in Cuba than they are in the United States. So thus, infant mortality statistics in the U.S. and Cuba are not apples-to-apples comparisons. So, the final argument against capitalism is that it's just icky. It's just not beautiful. You know, it's just not, it's not the way that I would like to see the world run. You know, we pursue our own self-interest, and there's something ignoble about that. The only response to that is if your criticism of capitalism is purely aesthetic, then the question I have to ask is, well, who are you to impose your aesthetic preferences on everybody else? And then second, given the history of attempts to replace capitalism with socialism in the 20th century, on what grounds are we to believe that anyone who wishes to replace capitalism with a more beautiful system is to be trusted? Because it's fairly obvious that if they're not willing to deal with the body count associated with socialism in the 20th century, that they're just not doing their homework. So I think the aesthetic criticism of capitalism it's a little bit outside the realm of economics, obviously, but I don't think that it holds much water. You can say, okay, well, capitalism is not beautiful. Well, I honestly think capitalism is beautiful. I am drinking tea right now. In fact, I'm going to go get a little bit more hot water in just a second before we get to the Q&A. But I'm, you know, the guy who delivers the water, I mean, we don't really know each other. I don't know the people who are producing the water. I don't know the people who produce the tea. I don't even know if they would like me. But strictly by virtue of the fact that they have goals and I have goals, and we're able to meet up in this nexus of exchange that is the market economy, we're able to cooperate with one another for mutual benefit. Jonathan Sachs, I think, who is a chief rabbi of Great Britain, recently, said one time, and I believe he's quoted in Paul Haynes' book, Are Economists Basically Immoral?, which I would encourage you to read. It's available for free online at the Library of Economics and Liberty. He said, it is through exchange that differences become a blessing rather than a curse. And I think it was Milton Friedman who said that one of the great things about a market economy is that people who might not just dislike each other but have positive antipathy toward one another can, in fact, cooperate to mutual advantage and make one another better off through this beautiful little thing that we call exchange. Well, clearly we can do better than capitalism, can we not? And the answer to that is an obvious no. May 1st is May Day, the day that everyone celebrates the Communist Revolution. Later tonight, I'm going to post my new Forbes article that's going to be about May Day. I reviewed Eugene Richter's Pictures of the Socialistic Future, which I asked you to read. I believe it was for our last little bit of time together. The answer to we can clearly do better is fundamentally Hayekian. No, we can't. Okay, we cannot do better than capitalism. We cannot do better than free markets. We can't do better than voluntary interaction. And attempts to do better created a pile of bodies, hundreds of millions of people high, okay? Not just through socialism, but through statism in its less extreme varieties. We killed something like 260 million people in the 20th century. And if you look at the number of people who died just in Stalin's gulags, you're dealing with something like 20 million human beings. These are people who had names. These are names we might not ever know, but these were significant human beings created in the image of God who were destroyed and wiped out in an attempt to rebel against the basic things that economics has to teach and to replace them with a vision of a new world. It was a vision of a new world that ultimately created a nightmare and that almost drowned civilization in blood. We can't do better than capitalism. And it is fortunate, I think, that free markets, when left to their own devices, they deliver the goods. They deliver the goods for the least of these among us. So they make the poor better off. They ennoble us spiritually. They expand our full humanity. They allow us to participate in social networks that we would not have access to in the absence of capitalist innovation. And they provide us with the things that are most essential to a well-functioning and truly great life. So that's my story for the evening. We have about 15 minutes left. I'm happy to take any questions. I'm going to look under my desk very briefly for something that I just dropped. Like I said, I'm going to grab a little bit more hot water. I will be back in 30 seconds at the most. All right. Thank you for your patience. So we've got, okay, great, excellent. This is a wonderful question. In response to the criticism that capitalism despoils the environment, can you comment on the tragedy of the commons? All right. So first of all, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to send you to a link, bunnygame.org. That's a video game, actually, that was produced by the Institute for Humane Studies that explains the tragedy of the commons in some detail. Bunnygame.org. I don't know what bunnygame.com is. So make sure it's .org. Actually, I want to know what bunnygame.com is, but bunnygame.org is the IHS game that explains the tragedy of the commons. So the idea of the tragedy of the commons is that when things are commonly owned, i.e. when they're not owned privately, people are going to have an incentive to overexploit them because everyone pays the costs, and the costs are dispersed over a large number of people. Okay, bunnygame.com is a non-site. Thank you, Doug, for taking the taking the risk there. I've been burned before with URLs. So the tragedy of the commons basically says when everyone owns something, no one owns it, and therefore no one has an incentive to conserve, because everyone bears the cost, and one person gets all of the benefits. Consider commonly owned sharks. Sharks are common property, presumably. If I happen across a shark while I'm out fishing or something like that, and I know that the shark is valuable, if I let the shark go, I can be reasonably certain that someone else is going to get that shark. So my incentive is to kill the shark. My incentive is to catch the shark rather than let it go out to breed and produce little baby sharks that can be then used to create value later. We can be reasonably certain that when things are commonly owned, people are going to have incentives to overexploit those things that are commonly owned, and thereby reduce our overall well-being. So people are going to overexploit common property resources, and that is the essence of the tragedy of the commons. Now, Eleanor Ostrom won the Nobel Prize in 2009. Largely for her work on the various ingenious ways that people have created bottom-up solutions to govern common property resources without a centralized authority, say, coming in and reassigning private property rights. Because property rights are necessary, they're not always sufficient for economic growth, and sometimes when we call something, when we call something private property, it often might just be redistribution. So small scale societies might develop norms and whatnot that help them to govern the use of common property through voluntary mechanisms and voluntary channels without some type of centralized authority. So those of you who are interested in studying economics further at a deeper level, I would highly recommend looking up Eleanor Ostrom's work. People come up with voluntary ways to govern common property resources. Okay, so Walmart. Could it be argued that since Walmart is so large and makes massive profits, the loss of profits due to gender discrimination is simply worth the profit gained from either being negligent about it or outright being sexist? Okay, so does Walmart make massive profits? No, they don't, actually. The return on equity for Walmart is very, very low, though. I mean, profit margins in retail are razor thin. And Walmart's returns on investment for Walmart are going to be about the same as they are everywhere else. So since Walmart is so large and makes profits, since they compete in markets for labor and markets for capital, we can be pretty sure that if people are dissatisfied with working at Walmart because of discrimination or what have you, they're going to go work somewhere else, because the skill set you need to work at Walmart can apply to a number of different occupations. I reviewed a book. I reviewed several books about Walmart that have been written by people who are not economists, and one of them talks about how exploited the people who work at this particular Walmart happen to be. And my question is always, well, if working at Walmart is so bad compared to the alternatives, then why are you not out looking for another job? Or why is not Target opening this door and hiring the entire Walmart workforce and literally eating Walmart's lunch? So I think Doug's question is perhaps plausible. You know, maybe it's been said that the best of monopoly profits is a quiet life. So maybe maybe the losses from discrimination might be worth whatever pleasure you get from it, or negligence. And it's true that monitoring costs are going to matter. So there's almost certainly going to be some types of discrimination that will persist and that will be kind of difficult to root out as a result of the cost of monitoring that kind of thing. But the fact of the matter is, Walmart is not a monopoly. They're competing in a very, very, very competitive market for labor, for capital, and for customers. And if they're engaged in systematic discrimination, eventually that's going to reveal itself through their bottom line. All right. Okay, also a capitalism game here. Download free games, simulate. Okay. Ooh, neat. Okay. Well, that's kind of cool. I'm gonna have to check that out. A friend of mine in the psych department is he's on this email discussion list where there are some people, and so any of you who are like serious computer types out there, you might be kind of interested in this. There are some people who are trying to design economics games using Flash. So they're making these little economics role playing games, which actually sound really awesome. Basic economics using RPGs. I'd encourage you guys to look that up and see if there's anything you can contribute or any way you can modify. By all means, let me know. Okay, ideas about the lack of environmental calculation. When there's interventionism in the name of environmental protection. Okay, so where did this come from? So almost exactly 2 years ago, I come back to my office after teaching my Econ 323 Classical and Marxian Political Economy class, and our student worker says, "Hey, did you see the poster in the elevator?" And I said, "Okay, well, yeah, sure, I saw the poster." I said, "Okay, I'm not sure which poster she's talking about." She said, "It's one that said someone is destroying the environment." I said, "Okay, yeah, I've seen that poster." And she said, "Someone wrote under it. It was Mark Carden." So I looked at the poster, and it was a friend of mine, actually, Mike Hammack, who taught at Rhodes for a couple of years. He's a fellow Mises University graduate. I think really fantastic guy. But I wrote a paper about it called Economic Calculation in the Environmentalist Commonwealth, which I'm currently re-revising for the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. Basically, this suggests that any kind of environmentalist intervention is going to necessarily run into problems of economic calculation and ultimately run into the knowledge problem, which is, how do we know that a particular environmental intervention is creating wealth? Or how do we know that a particular environmental intervention is doing what we expect it to do in the absence of the market process? So in the case of something like recycling, it's almost impossible. It's almost impossible to know, absent free markets, absent private ownership of the means of production, and absent free and unregulated trade, whether you're actually creating value or not. When you destroy the profit and loss signals inherent in the market economy, you literally destroy the information that you would need in order to know whether you're using resources wisely or not. So you might be able to define some metric, like we want to keep however much plastic out of the landfill or something like that, but you cannot, by socializing the means of environmental protection, know again whether you're using resources wisely or not. I think the policy implication of that will be private property for all and common property for none, or to try to find ways to establish or discover private property rights to the use of natural resources like air, water, land, etc. Murray Rothbard's classic article, Law, Property Rights, and Air Pollution, I think is very, very good about this. Okay, does creating a market for carbon emissions at all make sense as an effort to make air private, or is it a misadventure in creating a false market? Okay, so the multiracial character of Major League Professional Sports be a good response to the criticism that capitalism is structurally racist? Yeah, absolutely, I think so. That's one of the areas that racial integration is really straightforward. I would be a little bit careful about something like sports, because often, say in the case of college sports, these are run by capitalist enterprises that are attached to socialist enterprises. So it's a little bit odd. In fact, I'll do a little bit of show and tell here. I buy a lot of books, as one might expect. This is a new book that I added to my shelf by Charles Klotfelter, called Big Time Sports in American Universities, so I look forward to reading. As a graduate of the University of Alabama, I know a little to a lot about big time sports in American universities. I'd be interested in seeing kind of the implications of that. So back to Doug's question and then Gregor's question about privatizing the local water supply. Of all of the different ways for governments to intervene, there are very bad ways to do it, and there are less bad ways to do it. Given that government is going to do something, I think the carbon market is a much better idea than a lot of other things that have been proposed. I don't think it's going to work quite the way that a lot of people want it to, but it's a whole lot better than command and control, that's for sure. And I'm also not entirely convinced that it is inferior to gas, to higher petroleum taxes or something like that. Now, the big problem, of course, is figuring out exactly what the price of carbon should be. And that's going to so basically what's going to happen as a result, what's going to happen here is going to be a type of market socialism, I think, which is, I think, going to be better than full-blown socialism, but demonstrably worse than a free market. Someone you should look up is a gentleman by the name of Richard Sandor. So go ahead and type that out here. He was actually the founder of the Chicago Climate Exchange, and he spoke at Rhodes a few weeks ago, gave a fantastic presentation on some of the things that he's up to. I'm a little bit less he's very much a realist in terms of politics. He said this is either going to be done by politicians, or it's going to be done by markets in some sense. So we're going to have a market. It may not be a perfect market, or we're going to have political control. So it's pick your poison. Do you want the lesser of two evils? I think is a carbon market. Privatizing local water supply. Am I in favor of that, and how would it work? Am I in favor? Yes. How would it work? Honestly, I don't know in detail, because that's part of the virtue of markets, is that markets reveal how things like that would ultimately work. Water's kind of interesting. Again, the person I would look up, because everything I know about the economics of water, I know from reading, I know from hanging around with a gentleman by the name of David Zetland, who is, and Doug says, if we do have something that would work, it'd be a case for interventionism, which is exactly correct. You want to put me in charge? Why not? I like water, you know. I've got a PhD in economics, and I've written papers and all sorts of other wonderful stuff, my wife thinks I'm smart, so why not? Let's give this a go. How would privatizing the local water supply work? I don't know precisely. I would like to see market prices for water. So, for example, our local water utilities, Memphis Light, Gas, and Water. I would like to see that privatized. What I would do is I would issue ownership shares of MLGW to everyone who lives and pays taxes in the city of Memphis or in Shelby County or whatever government organization it is that owns MLGW. And these rights would also include rights to the water sources that MLGW is using. And I think that would ultimately help us to establish market prices for water and therefore lead to more rational use of water. How would it work specifically? I don't honestly know, but I do know that when you have free exchange of private property, people will come to a solution. All right. Any additional questions? I have time to take one. If you have not seen it yet, then by all means, the next thing you should do as soon as we're finished, if you have time, is watch the new Keynes Hayek rap video. It is absolutely spectacular. Again, it features a great performance from Michael Munger, another cameo from Edward Stringham. And again, and like I said, I mean, this has me completely geeked out about it. The fact that it's Joe Salerno as me in the video. I think that's absolutely fantastic and absolutely wonderful. So our last meeting of our term will be next week. So I am going to answer Steve Chipman's question, and that'll be it here in just a second. But like I said, I've promised, and I've been slow about putting up quizzes on the lectures and things like that. But what we will do is next week we'll wrap up, and then I will put a final exam up that will consist of 100 multiple choice questions. It'll be curved so that the average is like a 75 or something. And then however you choose to get credit for the class, if you want it, send me an email if you need some type of letter or something for whatever, if you're getting credit through whatever college or university that you're part of, or if you're homeschooling or something like that. We can get all that figured out. And again, what I want to do when I find time, and I'm going to try to do at least a little bit of this tomorrow, is put together quizzes based on the individual lectures and the readings. But Steve Chipman's question, does simple envy play a role in the criticism of capitalism? It absolutely positively does. Paul Hain referred to what he called the sanctification of envy as the one of the guiding impulses or one of the guiding motivations for interventionism. And the philosopher Michael Humer at the University of Colorado said one time when we were talking about these sorts of questions about how, you know, my inequality might be bad, he said, but envy is a vice, not a virtue. And indeed, I think that's a big part of what we're having to deal with as we explore and indeed try to defend the liberal capitalist market order. Other people to look up, Victor Klar, who used to be at Hope College in Michigan. He's now at Henderson State University in Arkansas. He and one of his colleagues have a good book. I don't think I actually have it on my shelves anymore, but it's A Christian Perspective on Economics. And he and someone else have a neat article with a neat title. And the title is Grieving the Good of Others. It talks about envy as a constraint on public policy. So lots and lots of reading suggestions and lots of people to look up. Richard Sander, David Zetland, Victor Klar, Paul Haynes' book, Are Economists Basically Immoral, which is a fantastic and wonderful read. Chapters are short enough for a little bit before bed every night. And the Keynes Hayek rap video featuring Keynes, Hayek, Michael Munger, Edward Stringham, and again, like I said, in a brilliant casting move by the people who put this together, Joseph Salerno as Ludwig von Mises. So with that, thank you again for your time, your energy, and your attention, and look forward to wrapping this up next week when we will talk about why socialism is still so popular.